Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You're listening to The Sound of London. This is Londonist Out Loud. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and there was a lot of introductory jibber-jabber in last week's episode, and so I'm going to keep this week's to a minimum. We're nonetheless continuing with a slightly morbid theme. Last week we were talking Jack the Ripper. This week we're all about London's cemeteries. Thanks very much, by the way, to those who sent in very positive comments about last week's episode. If you haven't listened to it yet, please do. If you haven't subscribed yet, definitely worth thinking about pressing that button. Well, look, I promise to keep it short, and I'm as good as my word. Let's get ourselves over to Hampstead.
Hey baby, let me take you down. So we'll play some strange sights and sounds you ain't never seen the like before. Just a stone's throw from your front door. Hey baby, sniff out me. See me to the air, land in the sea. Some creep, some saw down the road, jam brand store.
My heart aches for some far off place. No one
Well, hello, hello, listener. I am lapping up summer. I'm on the steps of a chapel in Hampstead Cemetery today, and with me is somebody who describes the art of understanding graveyards as being like enjoying scratch cards. Sheldon Goodman is a cemeteries expert, a Westminster tour guide, and I'm going to be finding out who is here. Hi, Sheldon.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm good. I was a bit disappointed. I thought I was here to meet someone called Sheldon Cooper.
Yep, you had to go there, didn't you? Thank you for that. Cheers. Thank you.
Quite genuinely, this is the appointment that's in my diary.
Yes,
Sheldon, I don't even watch that show.
No, neither do I, for a good reason.
We're off on the right foot.
Yeah. Yep.
As we look to our right, by the way, from these steps, there's a building on the other side of the street looking down the central drive of the cemetery, and that used to be...
It used to be a monumental mason, sourcely when people were buried here and people wanted to commemorate their beloved and their loved ones. Where would you go to kind of find a suitable memorial for them? Well, they just popped over the road to the masons that was there. I can't remember the name of it exactly, but obviously it's ideally placed considering where the cemetery is. And, you know, in there they would have had brochures, examples of particular headstones and so on. And, you know, they would have made a roaring trade from it.
Most importantly, you don't want to be carrying something that heavy too far, do you?
No. I mean, let's not forget this is before vans and cars and such, like, you know, any of these big memorials that you see in London nowadays would have been moved by traditional horse and cart, and, you know, good old-fashioned hard labour would have, you know, put them into place, and it would have been a formidable undertaking, especially if you were rich, you know.
A formidable undertaking.
That was quite unexpected. But yeah, again, you know, especially if you were rich and you wanted to, you know, really show off your wealth and how much the person meant to you, you chose a big memorial, and, you know, the labour that would have gone into constructing it and putting it into place would have not only reflected the money spent on it, but also the status of the person it's, you know, looking to commemorate.
And we've picked this one. There are lots of places that we could go to explore the subject of London's cemeteries, and we'll look at the overview of them as well as looking at who's buried here. What made us pick this one in particular?
Well, I actually visited this one a couple of weeks back, as I run a blog called Cemetery Club, and usually me and a number of people now go around the London cemeteries and just write about various ones. I mean, it's simply a case of seeing what's on a map, picking one, and then going to visit it and seeing what's what. So I chose this one a couple of weeks back. And I fell in love with it. I thought, well, this is a particularly nice one. Because I think, especially if you're unfamiliar with the cemetery scene in London, like it's some sort of nightclub, if you are aware of cemeteries in London, I'm sure many people would have heard of Highgate or Brompton, and others which are also known as the Magnificent Seven, which is a ring of Victorian cemeteries that circle London, which upon their opening would have been in the countryside. That was a historical name that was given to them in the 1980s. When they opened at the time, they weren't known as that. And certainly when they did open, they were just cemeteries. They revolutionised the way that we treated and buried our dead in London, because, as I'll go into later in the podcast, it was a fairly gory business if you happened to die in the early 19th century. But obviously, as a result of those seven opening, successive ones opened. And this one, Hampstead Cemetery, opened in 1876 as a result of this kind of reformation in burial. And it's just nice to see the evolution that happened from like the likes of Abney Park and Tower Hamlets to this one, as I said, which opened in the 1870s.
So is this yet another... This is incredible in this city. Is this yet another example of the Victorians thinking big and thinking about the municipal infrastructure of the capital?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, these places were... I mean, obviously, there were places where you buried, you know, your Auntie Enid or whatever, but there were also places where you came on a Sunday for a nice little gentle walk. Because especially when they were new, these were open parklands. I mean, we're familiar with cemeteries now being full of marble headstones or granite tombs and such like, but actually, when in their early days, and certainly in the middle of their lives, they were actually fairly open spaces, and people, you know, would make a concerted effort to come and visit these lovely places. And a number of these cemeteries actually employed very well-known landscape gardeners to tend to their needs, essentially. For example, the guy who did this one was a guy called Joseph Fife Meston. Again, a name most people probably wouldn't have ever heard of, but the other work he did was Victorian Embankment Gardens. So, again, you know, they really did put an effort in. I mean, obviously, they wanted to make these places as nice as possible, but let's not forget these places operated on profit. They wanted to make money. And how are you going to do that if you've got an utter shambles of a cemetery? You needed to make it nice. You needed to make it pristine.
They charged an admission fee?
They didn't charge an admission fee, but they certainly charged for burials, obviously, because they were a business, you know. They were in the business of making money, so...
Now, what were the alternatives at this point? If you were making money from putting people in the ground here, was it the case that better to do family would try to get a more attractive position for their recently deceased family member, or was the social kudos in where you were buried? How did it work?
It does depend. Most cemeteries, such as this one, has a grand drive, a grand avenue, which leads up to the very pretty chapel up the top there. Now, this would have been the prime space for people to be buried. This certainly probably would have been the most expensive plots. I mean, you can see, there's just one off in the distance. There's a tomb there that resembles an Egyptian temple. Obviously, they would have thrown a large amount of money at that, and they wanted to make a statement. They wanted to say this person in life was well-respected, well-to-do, did well.
And Egyptian.
And I don't know if he was Egyptian. I couldn't look that up. But obviously, the deeper into the kind of into the bowels of the cemetery you go, the grandeur does kind of lessen somewhat, obviously, because the plots were cheaper. But also, I think, more so, those were the people who didn't want to show off. They just wanted a simple place to bury their loved one. And, you know, as I'll take you around shortly, you'll see that kind of transition.
Let me paint a picture here, and it's a beautiful day for picture painting, I must say. The sky is gorgeous. It's got that lovely cotton wool effect on it. The sunshine is piercing through, but it also looks very hazy and gentle, like we're in a painting. Yep. And as you look down the central boulevard of the cemetery here, that effect that you're talking about with the more ostentatious, perhaps, graves with their pinnacles and peaks lining the boulevard kind of gives the impression of, well, if you were at Legoland and you were looking at their Monuments of the World section, yeah. That's what you get. And then you look a few rows back and you see much simpler crosses and many more of them per square foot, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And also, you know, back when this opened, there weren't the mature trees that we have now. So obviously it would have been... You would have seen a lot more monuments than you would have done today. Obviously now you've got the nice contrast between monument and nature, which is nice. And obviously that's another thing as well that cemeteries in London are becoming known for, is that they are literally becoming wildlife habitats now. So, you know, the dead are almost sheltering the living in a way, which is a nice little kind of afterthought, I think, of cemetery progression, really.
Can we talk about you for a moment?
If you like.
We'll do it in this order. We'll do you and then all of London.
Okay.
who are you? Sheldon, a wonderful name, by the way. Sheldon.
Thank you. Please don't mention the show.
How did you get into doing this?
Especially when people see how young and beautiful I am. I
can see how young you are.
Well, how dare you. My interest has always been there. I came into a family where I didn't know my grandfathers, so I knew both my grandmothers, and it was many, many times a year we would go to the cemetery to pay our respects to my various grandfathers. And it was always, you know, a very, not solemn affair, but it was something that was always to be done. And I was just fascinated that these, like, little plots drew people to such an extent. And then when my grandparents eventually, or my grandmothers eventually passed away one by one in 2001, one in 2010, it was interesting to see the effect that it had on my family, how the dynamic changed. And that kind of spurned my interest in it because... And another thing as well, and it's a slightly morbid thought, is that, you know, these women tended these graves knowing full well one day they'd end up there. I mean, what does that do to you? I don't have a plot. I don't know where the hell I'm going to end up. But what does that do to someone, you know? And it was that kind of, not fixation, but certainly that interest, you know, in it's almost like personal pilgrimages, going to these places and seeing, you know, eventually many of the people who tend these graves will end up in those very plots themselves that kind of started it all, really.
There must be that same kind of memento mori effect for you, though, as you're spending so much of your time contemplating, in, I suspect, a very ordinary way, mortality.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I'd agree with that.
And I've kind of got doctors in my mind for some reason who have to deal with the fact of us being living things that pass out of the state of being living, and there being various stages of passing out. Do you feel especially in touch and at peace with the fact that you're going to die one day?
It's just part of the deal. You know, I've often, you know, people often said, oh no, but one day I'm going to be dead. I'm like, well, that's, you know, you're dying for the moment you're born. That's just how it is.
Okay, now we tipped over a point, I think.
Indeed. But it's a point nonetheless.
I think it's not true as well, isn't it? Aren't we still growing and improving until somewhere in our teens?
Well yeah, we are. But you know, we are fighting a losing battle, to put it very, you know, bluntly. And it will happen one day. So, you know, I'm very, you know, kind of not okay with it. I want to live forever. You know, I want to regenerate like Doctor Who, ideally. But that's not going to happen. So it's just part of the deal.
So as you enter a cemetery, and I'm guessing you've seen a vast majority of them in London already, but as you enter a cemetery, perhaps when you're already familiar with, what are you looking for, first of all? What catches your attention?
Well, I'd say the first thing are any kind of big standalone notable monuments, because obviously, you know, especially when you first come into the cemetery, they're deliberately placed there, because especially when these places opened, they were one of the unique selling points. You know, put all the kind of the richer people towards the entrance, because it makes us look a bit grander and a bit showy.
So you're a sucker for bling?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I probably shouldn't admit that, but I am. And then once you get over that and you think, okay, but, you know, it's all very well having these big showy monuments and mausoleums and such like, let's get a little bit deeper now, and that's when you can venture off the beaten path, so to speak, and see what else is here.
Well, we've turned more or less at random into a side path off the main boulevard. And what catches your attention here?
Well, we've got two monuments here. There's one, I don't know who these people are, but on one of them there's actually sheet music. I'm not sure who this person was in life. Perhaps he was, let's see his name. Charles Webster Miller, and there's sheet music on it. Now, obviously, music was a big part of his life. And it's reflected on the, frankly, very impressive monument that his family chose to have dedicated to him. Obviously wasn't cheap, and it was obviously put there to obviously make a statement about the man himself.
And you've picked a particularly interesting one there as well, haven't you? Because the style of ostentation in many of these graves involves pillars and classical references and grandeur. Whereas these, I mean, they're enormous, these two crosses next to each other, his and that of Henry George Randall. But both of them have been designed to look lo-fi. So with each of them, you've got a rock that's been carefully made to look rugged and unconstructed.
Yeah.
And then a cross in a similar style, very simple but enormous cross on the top. So they seem to be saying something about, yes, we're important, but we're also humble.
Yeah, very much so. And also, you'll probably see there's a large number of Celtic crosses around here. You'll see them dotted around. And that's because at one time there's a very big Scottish contingent here. And obviously they chose to be commemorated with the Celtic cross to kind of symbolise where they came from.
So, Charles Webster Miller's caught your eye. What do you do now? Is this a moment where you would start digging?
So let's.
Not
literally. Whoa, hold your horses.
I'm definitely keeping in
mind. Blimey. So I just read his head. So Charles Webster Miller, a Royal Opera Covent Garden. So immediately I'm thinking, oh, hello.
I've got to retake that. I can't leave that in. That's going in an outtake show if I'm not careful.
It was a slip of the tongue, perfectly acceptable.
Beautiful. Is this the moment where you whip out Wikipedia and start finding out who the fellow was?
It is. I mean, I'd go to see, so let's say, Charles Bester Miller. So then I'd take a couple of steps forward to the headstone, and I see Royal Opera, Covent Garden, something opera. This is where I get even closer now. Let's have a look. I can't make that out. Opera company and principal concertist. So clearly he was a musician. So immediately I'd get on my phone, put him into Google, and see what came up. And that's another thing as well, which is remarkable about these things. You just wander around thinking, well, these people aren't going to be on Google. Well, yes, they are. A lot of them are. And they've got biographies. And, you know, it's rather peculiar to think that, you know, people whose lives never even saw the internet, were never touched by it, are there, waiting to be discovered. I mean, my sight reading of music, I'm not even going to attempt it because I'm actually a bass and that's a soprano line. But I would try and sing that at the grave. But I'm not going to, because I'll just sound like an idiot.
Beneath it, it says, "All my heart is buried with you. All my thoughts go onward with you." Yep. Evelyn. And that, of course, makes me think about the relationships that are hinted at on the headstones.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's also a very telling one about the headstone as well. You'll see there's a very big gap underneath. Now, obviously, I don't know. I put a good amount of money that he had a wife who was supposed to end up there and then didn't.
Now, when you say a gap underneath, I'm looking at the headstone and I can see that the panel on the front of it there, that's got that text and music etched into it,
yeah,
stops short of the ground by about 6 inches, maybe a little less.
Yeah.
How do you deduce what you just deduced from that?
Well, if you look at the next headstone, you'll see it says Anna Maria, who was the wife of Henry George Randall. Now, obviously, she died before him. So originally, that would have looked like that. So there would have been a gap where Henry George Randall's epitaph is now. You'll see it's there, and there's nothing. Now, for something so grand, I find it very unusual. I mean, I don't know, I might be wrong. He might have just wanted this grave for himself. I don't know. But it's just unusual to find that area blank, in my mind.
Well, that raises all sorts of interesting possibilities.
It does. It does. Did she move away? Which is quite possible if her husband died, or if he indeed was married. Where did she go? She might have moved with the children. She might have decided to kind of have a fresh start elsewhere. That kind of thing.
So there's the whiff of intrigue.
Yeah, exactly.
Right away.
Exactly. So you just kind of think, okay. I mean, most people, you know, wouldn't have thought of that. But that's one thing I've picked up from running the blog and visiting all these cemeteries and such like. You know, there's these kind of little hidden stories going on, which, you know, again, just waiting to be discovered.
Let's move on. I need to ask a little bit about grave etiquette here, because in order to get to that grave, we had to step across two others. It doesn't look to me as though the one on the left here, Peter Lucas's grave, it doesn't look to me as though that's remotely long enough for him to be buried lying down, or we just walked across his grave.
Yep.
What are the rules here in your mind?
Well, I personally, and I probably sound like a complete nutcase for doing this, whenever I do, obviously to get to some grade you have to do that, I always just say, oh, terribly sorry, excuse me, just, I probably sound like a blithering idiot really, but it's just my way of saying, I'm terribly sorry, don't mean to walk on your grave, because I find it disrespectful, but sometimes it can't be helped. So I just, you know, just give a little, terribly sorry.
We hear about those overcrowding issues, especially in the East End graveyards. Have you any idea of how many people are buried in each grave? Do you get sort of multiple occupancy going on here?
You do, yes. I mean, some of these plots, especially the larger ones, were supposed to be for entire families. I mean, especially in places like Highgate and West Norwood, there were huge vaults which were supposed to accommodate up to 20 people. Because of one reason or another, perhaps migration, the fact that opening up these graves was actually so expensive, it was just cheaper to buy another one. A lot of them only have like about 4 or 5 people in them.
What do you mean opening up the graves?
So you've got these graves here. We'll use this Middle Martin as an example.
Okay, we're looking at something that's like a postbox on a plinth in size.
Yeah. Now that's not obviously the biggest monument I've ever seen, but certainly some of them have been huge, whacking great, you know, marble blocks. And so obviously to inter someone into that, you'd have to disassemble it. To get the coffins in. Now, the problem was is that sometimes the cost of doing that was just so great, the family just thought, let's just get another plot. It's just not worth it. Not so much in that case. That would be a fairly regular one to do, but that's the kind of you know, thing that would have happened.
Let's check your subterranean knowledge. The item there that we described, it's tall and the area of it is about a foot and a half square. And then there's a stone border around the edge of the allotment there. And if you took that off, I reckon what you're left with is the footprint of a smallish shed. How would the family be positioned in there?
Probably one on each side. So I think that's two plots which have just been merged into one. They'd be a coffin, then probably about, I don't know, 4 foot or something. Coffin, another 4 foot, coffin. So very similar to today, really.
Let's keep moving.
So just up here, we've got our first notable grave. And certainly her memory does linger on because she was the darling of not only London, but the UK generally. Well, the world even. She was a massive superstar, and that's Marie Lloyd, who was one of the, you know, one of our greatest music hall stars. Jesse Wallace portrayed her in a drama very recently. This lovely kind of, again, Celtic cross, which has just gone a bit wobbly, obviously, because of ground settlement. But here she is. Now, the interesting thing about Marie, when I do my tour of Tower Hamlets, I actually speak about another music hall star by the name of Alec Hurley. Now, obviously, in the late 19th century, there were loads and loads of entertainers, well, much as there are today, who were household names. Now, he actually met Marie Lloyd when they were touring America, and they fell in love. They became lovers. Problem was that she was married, so they kind of had to keep it on the down low. Then eventually her first relationship broke up, and she then ended up kind of having a relationship with him. It was a very good match to begin with, but the problem was is Marie was such a big superstar, it actually her career started to eclipse his own. And I don't think he was ever really particularly happy with that. He became very depressed, and like so many people of the day, he turned to the bottle to console himself with the fact that his wife's superstardom was
just... The fact that his wife was successful.
Well, you know, it was. I think, you know, it's when you've got your own career to worry about, and you say, obviously he wanted to be happy for her, but I don't know, maybe he had self-confidence issues or whatever. But anyway, he started to kind of lose confidence a bit. And then she met a 24-year-old jockey by the name of Bernard Dillon.
I sent another bottle for the husband.
Well, you're not wrong. She then decides to go off with Bernard and leave poor old Alec in the lurch. He never got over that. And it really did dent his career. He, again, just completely lost himself to the bottle. And he died in Jack Straw's castle in Hampstead. He was tragically young. Only in his 40s or 50s, and he ended up being buried not in Hampstead where he lived, but in Tower Hamlets, where he's buried in his mother's grave. Marie, obviously, her superstardom went, you know, it just reached new heights all the time. She extensively toured Europe and America. However, the union between her and Bernard was not a happy one. She did suffer, unfortunately, the hands of domestic violence. There's a story where a policeman was called to their house and he found her cowering under a table while he was just, you know, going about in a rage, swinging his fists around. And again, you know, to someone who was so bombastic in life, it really did dent her self-confidence and indeed her career. And Virginia Woolf, for example, saw her in the kind of dying days of her career and said basically she was all teeth. She had a crapulous way of saying the word desire, but clearly a born showwoman, but just clearly exhausted. And she died fairly close to poverty and had a massive funeral where thousands of people literally were all over this local area to witness her coffin being lowered. And one thing I found yesterday was there's actually footage of her funeral.
Really?
Which is remarkable. There's a number of websites you can find. The British Pathé, I think this was on the Huntley archive or something. And there's these six very Edwardian-looking pallbearers with her very impressive coffin on their shoulders. And then it's just this local area here where there are literally thousands of people dressed in black, being lowered into this very spot. But again, it's on my tours that I do, it's just you see how Marie's grave is and you compare it to her husband's, which is kind of lost in a dense forest almost. And it's just kind of, well, you know, for a while these two people were so mad in love with each other, and obviously life's path took them in different directions.
Do you fancy a specialist bonus question?
Go on.
Whenever I hear somebody described as a music hall star, I always wonder what that actually means. I have trouble visual in the same way that if you were to say in the present day that somebody's a TV star, it doesn't really tell you what they did. Do you happen to know what she did?
She was a performer. She started performing at a very young age. She mainly did it to entertain her eight siblings, but she was obviously a natural showwoman, as I said before.
What did she perform?
Songs, comedy acts, kind of thing. Her best known song is "The Boy I Love Is Up in the Gallery." That's a song that's usually used in old Victorian films of London, usually. Again, I would sing it, but I'm not going to. I'll have to charge you for that.
Very defensive.
Well, it's a talent. So she was known for going around...
Hang on, no, before we go any further. So we're getting this stuff for free because what?
Because I'm nice.
I'm now beginning to weigh the value of your words here if you're giving it away.
Well, I can sing it. Well, I'll sing it for you. The words, I'm a bit... Because I've just been put on the spot. So Marie Lloyd's best-known song was... The boy I love is up in the gallery. The boy I love is looking down at me. There he is. I've forgotten the words. Da-da-da-da. Handkerchief that sings on a robin that sits on a tree. Now, that's why I didn't do it, you see. And I'm doing it at her graveside. How disrespectful is that? I'm sorry, Marie.
I thought that was very impressive. I think if she was into comedy as well, I think she'd have liked la-la-la-la handkerchief.
She was saying, who is this young idiot here? What is he doing to my song? But anyway, she performed in the music halls, which were go-to destinations, really, for the Victorian society. You know, you went there to forget your troubles. You went to forget... you went there for a good time, but you also, you know, went there just to really enjoy yourself. So, and she was one of many of the stars. I mean, the other stars of the day included Dan Leno, Albert Chevalier, George Laban. The list is endless.
We're on the move again. I just wanted to draw your attention before we pass away from it to this grave here, and it is a fellow, part of his name's obscured, I think it's Giuseppe, and flowers have been recently placed at the headstone.
Yeah.
This is an unusual grave, though. Most of the graves are grassed over, and you can see only the headstone and anything masonry-oriented. Anything that's made out of stone is still there. But this grave gives the impression of having been recently covered over with earth. The pile of earth is nearly a foot tall in places. It looks like a recently filled grave. Few stones on there. What's this all about?
Well, you've got it quite right. It is a recently filled grave, obviously.
And yet it says that the people in this grave... No, I'm confused. So the headstone there doesn't belong to this grave?
I think it probably... I don't know, actually. It's...
Because the two people there were died in 26 and 88, respectively.
No, that's his birth date and that's his death date.
So he died in 88.
So he died in 88, and then you'll see that there's another... It's a book memorial. There's another page which is left blank, which I presume is for his wife.
Ah, so this might mean Mrs. Giuseppe...
Yeah,
recently arrived.
I don't know if this mound... Because it's set back slightly. I'm not sure if it's that... For this particular grave, it's probably because looking at the orientation of it, it probably is. But I presume that his wife has just recently joined him.
I genuinely mean this. I apologise if our conclusions are incorrect, because that might be distressing to the very much alive Mrs. Giuseppe and her family. So it could equally be that we're looking at a companion grave to the one on the right here, the family Scanlon, or indeed it could be something else altogether.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Again, it's impossible to tell if it's not kind of, you know, laid in front of you. But it's obviously a recent burial, very recent indeed, which just goes to show you that despite how long this cemetery's been open, it is still... taking people in. It's still a working cemetery, and that's all the more reason to be very reverential to the people who are buried here, because, you know, these are lives that were once loved and cherished, and, you know, people are still choosing to be buried here. So
just a question that has come up, because I see over the top of this grave there's a headstone there that seems very much, it seems like it's in the wrong place. It's that black fellow there that I'm looking at.
Yes.
And it's a different angle than some of the other ones, and it's sort of tucked half under a bush, and it looks a little bit adrift.
Yeah.
And it put me in mind of those churchyards that you see where the gravestones, the headstones are up against the perimeter wall.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on when you see that?
Well, in that instance, most of the time it's because the churchyard's been landscaped. They're too full, and the space is probably better used as like an open space where people can, you know, especially like in the city churchyards, people can just like have lunch. So it's easy just to kind of clear the headstones away and just put them around the periphery. In that one, it looks like what's known as infill, which is when the cemetery reaches the end of its working life, I guess, they start to use any available space possible, which means that sometimes headstones end up in places which don't really seem to fit the general layout and kind of plan of the cemetery. But again, it's just, you know, making use of the space that's there to keep the cemetery doing its original function.
Now, in those churchyards, does that mean that the correspondence between the headstone and its location has been completely surrendered? Do they no longer know who is where?
Well, they usually have like burial records, which would tell you. But I mean, if you were to look at headstone that in most like city churchyards, which have clearly been moved, doesn't mean that they're there. They've either been exhumed.
would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
And buried in a big grave elsewhere, or they're still there, but they've just kind of cleared the headstone away.
Well, I guess what I'm getting at is in those burial records, I don't remember ever having seen locations within the churchyard described, I guess because the people keeping that ledger will assume that the headstone will do that job for them.
Well, yeah, but they also have these big grids, which kind of tell you each burial. So let's say that, for example, like in the war, cemeteries weren't immune to being bombed. For example, in Tower Hamlets, that had a couple of direct hits, and local residents remember having their back garden showered with bones because obviously the bombs are going off and just exploding everywhere. But obviously the cemetery records still have kind of grid plans of where people were. So even though something as catastrophic as that happened, they still have a record who was there and who should have been there. But there's a particularly good memorial I just want to show you. It's a slightly strange one. Well, not strange, but for the person who's buried here. Because you wouldn't probably expect Hampstead to be the location of the burial place of one of the Prime Ministers of Australia.
Oh,
for example. So this is Andrew Fisher. Now, he was born in Crosshouse in Ayrshire in 1862, and he went over to Australia and became three times their Prime Minister in the early part of the 20th century on three separate occasions, as I said. Now, he was present at the unveiling of Canberra. There's actually a picture of him where he's standing atop this memorial with another Labour, an Australian Labour politician by the name of King O'Malley. And they're just unveiling the name of the new capital, and he's wearing a really nice coat as well. I do have a kind of soft spot for these Victorian Edwardian coats, and it's like, oh, I wish Next sold that. But anyway, he was not only the Prime Minister, he did other things as well. He actually set up the Commonwealth Bank in Australia. That was one of his achievements as well. He was involved in finance and mining. And again, one of these people who just kind of almost turned their hand to anything and just did it almost effortlessly. He actually came to be buried here because he retired. He succumbed to the effects of old age. He suffered from dementia towards the end, and he retired to Hampstead 3 years before he died. So he eventually passed away in 1928, which is why he's here. But I think he really did want to continue to be involved in the Australian political system. But I think age, and obviously there was a new breed of politician coming up as well, and they just thought, well, there's not really much point, really, which is quite sad. But yeah, this is, it's a fine monument to him. And obviously very proudly says, for 8 years, leader of the Australian Labour Party. He held a majority in the Australian Parliament, which was unheard of for a Labour politician at the time. So again, another notable here.
I'm looking at the dates that he was Prime Minister as well, and one of them, 1914 to 15. That's not a good time to be a Prime Minister of a country sending all those boys away.
No.
And you won't miss his grave either. It's one of the larger ones around here. I think the only one that's larger that I can see over there, and I think this goes beyond being merely a grave for one person, is a wall and gate topped by an angel with wings unfurled.
Yeah.
The name of Bianchi is visible.
Yeah, now this is one of the finest monuments that you'll ever see in London. It was actually carved by a stonemasons by the name of Farley, who were in Kensal Green. Now this is the grave of an opera singer, who I believe died in childbirth. I might be wrong on that one, but I think she died in childbirth. And her husband was so distraught at her passing that he erected this fantastic monument to her. Now the actual angel you see there is actually her in angel form. Now, originally, it looked a lot more impressive. It did have some very ornate metalwork. It had a nice gate here, and it had a nice backdrop. Sadly, it was the victim of scrap metal thieves in 2011, which is kind of...
You're kidding.
No, this is quite common. This is quite common in cemeteries. This cemetery, like many others, has suffered at the hands of scrap metal thieves. There's actually, on the main stretch there, there's a monument to a cigar merchant. He was also a poet, and he had this really ornate vase, which had like a bronze snake entwined around it. That went. I think they found it in an auction or something, and they found it. They put it in East Finchley Cemetery for safekeeping, and then it got stolen again, and they've never been able to locate it.
You'd have thought a cigar merchant would be cremated.
Well, quite. I don't know what to say to that.
I just wanted to say as well, because the listener couldn't guess, that as you stand in front of this monument, the slope of the hill stretching away, and I didn't realise quite how high up we are. As you look beyond the reliefs on the wall here, which, by the way, depict what I take to be the husband and wife sitting on a bench. I think she's got a child in her arms.
Yeah.
And you look beyond that wall and you can see the bowl of the capital behind it with the trees in the near ground.
And again,
it's a very restful place.
That would have been deliberate. Obviously, back in the day when it opened, those trees wouldn't have been quite as big. And that would have been the view. That would have been deliberate. They like to put cemeteries on hills simply because of the views it gave, you know. If people came here for Sunday walks and they saw that, it'd be beautiful.
To the right, well, I mean, I can only say this is in complete contrast, is a grave, and I'm not casting aspersions at all. It would be easy to, actually. At the end of the grave, which is in black and has pictures of a taxi cab, amongst other images, on the headstone, is a car license plate which seems to have the initials of the person who's buried there. An entirely different manner of remembering someone.
It is, but it also harkens back to the old Victorian values. For example, the Victorians love symbology. I mean, you'll see on many headstones there's the Ouroboros circle, which is the snake eating its tail, the clasped hand symbolising we'll meet again. His headstone is no different, except it just obviously has his passions on it. There's someone fly fishing and a black cab. I presume he was a cabbie, I don't know. But again, it's obviously people choosing to remember his interests, probably a little bit better than, let's say, a conventional headstone would, which is just a collection of words at the end of it. There, you've actually kind of got a taste of his passions.
Yeah, this is a much more personal grave than many of the others.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, let's press on.
Sure. Oh, just over there, there's Alan Corren. People are probably familiar with his son and daughter, Giles and Victoria.
And he was a Cricklewood resident.
He was indeed. He was indeed. And he was. He's a fairly recent burial here, in a very, very nice headstone. And it says, "Tomorrow to Freshwoods and Crickles New," which is nice, which is a nice little touch, I think. But yeah, so just walking down. This is where the cemetery kind of, the grandeur lessens, but, and this is, I think, where it becomes a little bit more real. This is where most people would end up, shall we say. The headstones are notably smaller.
Well, and some of the ones we're passing at the moment are really wrecked. The grave here of Robert Edward Douse, who died in 1946. I'd say this is about the size of a large double bed, a queen bed, and the tiles across the top of it. If you tried to walk across that, if that was a bit of pavement, you'd break your ankle.
Yep. But again, he died in 1946. When was the last time anyone came to kind of give any kind of upkeep to this grave? Decades ago, probably, by the looks of it. And that's the kind of, you know, what will happen to many of the graves here. I mean, some are impeccably kept. Some are, like poor Robert Edward Douse, just falling apart.
That seems particularly poignant when you read the inscription there. He was a devoted husband, father and friend.
Yep.
And you have to wonder
well, what happened to them? Because, I mean, they say people remain in living memory for about 70 years after their death, and then people just, you know, pass into the ages of time, which, you know...
Become a name.
Exactly, you know, and that's the point why I run the blog and why I do tours. I want to reinstate some of these people, you know, because some of their achievements, you know, they don't need to be celebrities, they don't even need to be famous. Some of them, you know, did some amazing things, and we shouldn't forget that.
Well, on that subject of memory, and of course we're in a garden of memories, that's what the purpose of this is in many ways.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, and we're coming up for a break, so it might be a bigger question than we can deal this side of it, but very often when you're in a cathedral or a church, you'll see those flagstone graves, and you know that the people are buried under there, but countless generations of feet have eroded the lettering.
Yeah.
And I often feel like, you know those ones where it's just about legible if you catch it at the right angle.
Yeah.
And I often think, well, okay, so this is the last moment, the very last moment of that person being sort of publicly remembered, isn't it?
Yes,
but this is the point of their final disappearance.
Exactly. The sum of all their achievements is just laid there. And, you know, as you say, you know, if you catch it in the right light, you can just about make out some of it, which is a great shame. But, you know... You know, let's hope, you know, in those instances, you know, that's acknowledged and perhaps their graves are refurbished or, you know, re-etched to kind of remember them.
So. Clearly, it's not always going to happen, though, as we've just seen.
No, it's not. I mean, obviously, in an ideal world, it would, but obviously, we're living in a world of the living. That sounds like a silly thing to say, but it's... And obviously, the needs of the living versus the needs of the dead. The cemetery space is running out. What to do?
Well, that's a good question, and we're going to take an overview of the cemetery scene as well. I gather there are politics aplenty, even amongst what you think would be a fairly calm and orderly arrangement of institutions around the city. But we'll be back after this word from our sponsor.
We have teamed up with audible.co.uk to offer you a free audiobook of your choice. All you have to do is register for 1 month free trial to claim your free audiobook. There are over 150,000 to choose from. The 30-day free trial means you can choose a free audiobook, which is yours to keep whether or not you decide to cancel in the trial period. And there's more good news. If you trialed the service over 12 months ago, the good people at Audible are giving you a chance to get your hands on another audiobook for free. So sign up at www.audible.co.uk/Londonist.
The Sound of London. Londonist Out Loud with N. Quentin Wolfe. Listen free every week on your favourite podcast platform. Subscribe via iTunes and get great extra content at Londonist.com. Tweet the show at Londonist Sound and see pictures of all our guests on the Londonist Out Loud stream on Instagram.
You're listening to Londonist Out Loud. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe. With me is Sheldon Goodman. He's a Westminster guide. And we're looking for alternative names for you if you should ever tire of Sheldon. How do you fancy Stebbing?
Yeah, why not? Why not? There's worse things to be called. Yeah, why not? Yeah. There are a number of names you could that shells if it so desires. Shelley, that's a popular one in the family.
This is a sad sight down here. Yeah, a lot of forgotten graves, I think.
Yes. Again, this is fairly sadly fairly typical. You know, everyone's got lives to lead, and you know, perhaps people can't visit graves as much as they'd like to. It's interesting to note that there's a grave over there which is covered in nasturtiums, which is kind of like a lily pad plant with these lovely orange flowers. That's actually edible. You can eat them. Not advising you do, but you can use them in salads. That's a nice little factoid for you.
So the London cemetery scene.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Magnificent Seven.
Yes.
What else have we got going on? Where else are people buried?
Well, as I said, there's those Magnificent Seven, but then there's also kind of set of other cemeteries which opened afterwards, this being one of them. Another example is Ladywell and Brockley. And then obviously, fast-forwarding a couple of years, there's places like Chiswick New Cemetery. There's one in Manor Park in northeast London. So, I mean, cemeteries are opening all the time, but it's continual. And obviously, with every one that opens, it reflects the burial practices of the day. You go to the newer ones, let's say like Manor Park, and you'll have the graves which are covered in like little windmills and like wooden fencing and little trinkets to kind of commemorate the person whose life is remembered there, which is obviously in contrast to these whacking great mausoleums you'll find in the grand old Victorian cemeteries, which, you know, again, remember them in a very slightly different, if not arguably more pompous way, really.
Well, I thought there was I thought that the housing crisis for the living was reflected in a similar space crisis for the dead.
Absolutely. I mean, if you go to places like Tower Hamlets, which has no space for its dead, it's had to rely on other boroughs and other places to find spaces for its dead to be interred. And this obviously leads to the important question is that, you know, burial space is running out. What to do about it? And it's a problem that isn't actually as new as people think, because this is exactly why these cemeteries opened in the first place. I mean, just to go back to the early 19th century, as I mentioned before, kind of in the first half, if you were to pass away in the early 19th century, your kind of options were limited as to if you wanted a dignified, respective burial. You know, there are reports that, like the old churchyards, which had served the local parishes for hundreds, if not thousands of years, were so overcharged with dead, there were bones sticking out of the ground, there were vermin gnawing on the limbs, and in some cases, some of them actually glowed blue at night, because they were so packed with decomposing bodies that the gases would illuminate the churchyard at night. That's the kind of situation we were faced with, and which is exactly why these places actually opened in the 1830s, 1840s, and started a completely different way of remembering.
As we pass through what is a much more shady area of the graveyard, you get the clear sense of a lot of these old graves falling into ruin. And there's something terribly romantic here about the ivy around the feet of the angel and winding its way around the crucifixes. Do you enjoy cemeteries?
I do enjoy. I think they're really quite peaceful places, you know, especially in the busy humble-tumble world of modern life. It's just nice. I mean, look, we're not a busy part of London, but can you hear really much traffic or much noise? It's almost silent apart from the birdsong. It's a nice kind of antidote, I think, to the lives that we lead nowadays, really.
Who else do you find frequenting cemeteries?
It's a whole kind of spectrum of people. You know, you've got dog walkers, you've got mums with kids, you know, just wanting a safe place to, you know, just walk with their children and so on. And, you know, obviously you've got mourners who are, you know, remembering the dead.
I've picked up on a number of people in previous connections who've used them as places to sleep rough.
Yes, yes. Again, they're sheltered, they're off the beaten track, so, you know, yeah, you know, they're I suppose, yeah, I wouldn't say ideal for it, but, you know, there's certainly a place where people choose to kind of take shelter.
So, because it would be remiss of us not to plug your tours a little bit, what are you up to in terms of tours? Which places do you haunt?
Well,
no, I've done it.
Okay, you see, it's very easy to just fall into these things. I do a number of them, but I do tours for Brompton Cemetery, Tower Hamlet Cemetery, and I've done Abney Park in the past as well. And they're very different cemeteries. I mean, obviously, they're all open at the same time. But they, you know, Abney Park were dissenters, where the alternative Christians, that's a bad way of putting it, but that's where they chose to be buried. Tower Hamlets, obviously, on the social scale of things, that's where many of the East End poor chose to be buried. And then Brompton, where all the kind of, you know, well, the great and the good were buried, really. I mean, just to stop briefly, that monument there, that is the one of the Grand Dukes of Russia. He was Nicholas II's great uncle, who lived over here in exile because, I think, a result of a morgantic marriage, which is where, let's say, a member of the high social class marries below or not equal to his station. And he lived over here for a number of time. And I remember George V... Was it George V? Yeah, it was probably George V who said he really wanted a title when he lived over here. So he basically wrote to George V asking for a title, and George V said to Nicholas II, he went, "Oh, that old boar has messaged me asking for a title again," which is quite sad, really, when you think he's like an older member of his extended family. But again, just little tales like that I like to share.
Did he get his title?
No, because he wasn't an English dignitary. He was Russian, so there was nothing he could have done. But I think somehow it did happen. I can't remember exactly, but
well, I'm English. I might be in with a shout.
You might be. You know the right people.
I never thought of writing.
You should. Worth a try, isn't it?
Right, I'm going to write. There's some interesting ones down here. We're just coming up for the chapel that was at the end of the boulevard when we started the tour, and now it's practically upon us. And to our left, we've got some of those Egyptian monoliths that we were talking about. There's a couple of interesting angels hewn out of the rock here, and a fallen... I've not seen one like this before, actually. Is it intended to be this way? Fallen Celtic cross?
No, it's just snapped off, so they've just laid it on top. Actually, I think that looks quite nice, actually. But obviously, at some stage, it's just kind of weathered or broken. And obviously, they don't want to remove it from the grave. They've just laid it on top.
Now, talk to me about this thing at the end here, which is church-like in appearance. It's got a couple of small buildings which are very much in the Gothic arch style of a traditional English church. There's what appear to be stained glass windows, and if they're not, they merely need the colouring to become them.
Yeah.
And in the centre is a tower, almost certainly a bell tower,
yeah.
And through the centre another arch that you could take a carriage and four through.
Mm-hmm. So this is where, obviously from where we started the podcast, we're just at the other end of the main drive now. This is where all the coffins would have come, or all the funeral processions would have come, to go into one of the two chapels. So that's, I'm not sure which one's which, but that's, one of them is the Dissenters Chapel, and the other is the Anglican Chapel. So the hearse would just stop just under that arch, the coffin would be unloaded, taken into the chapel for its service if it hadn't had it done elsewhere. Service would be concluded, and then they would come back out and then carry the coffin to its eventual destination. So, and this is a particularly fine example. Again, it's Gothic Revival, which again is a statement of architecture at the time, because when many of the cemeteries were originally built in the 1840s, there was a very big argument between classical architecture and Gothic architecture, which one should be the dominant style. And then like a little subsidiary of that was Egyptian architecture. By the time this place came around, the Egyptian thing was kind of, you know, considered old hat, really. They didn't bother with it. And again, that argument between Gothic and classical architecture raged on. And here they've obviously plumped for a Gothic Revival kind of style, which is incredibly impressive when you look at it.
And it seems to echo a lot of places that I feel like I know as well. It feels like it, in exactly the same way that you get that particular Art Deco look on a lot of the tube stations.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
It seems to be the trademark style.
And again, this was supposed to reaffirm the place. This is where you should bury your loved one, you know. This, you know, they've thrown a lot of money at this because they want to make a statement. You know, this is a nice place to be buried. And that's reflected in the vast range of people who ended up being buried here. For example, Joseph Lister, the pioneer of antiseptic surgery, he chose to be buried here. Without him, most of our modern medicine wouldn't be quite as, well, not saying pain-free, but certainly without his work, building on the work of Louis Pasteur, and, you know, making surgical implements sterile before, let's say, amputations or operations or what have you, we wouldn't enjoy the healthcare that we do today, really.
And it's remarkable as well, since we're surrounded by reminders that you don't go on forever. It always strikes me as remarkable that up until there or thereabouts in history, you could very easily perish from cutting yourself on something.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm just going back to Lister for a moment. You know, it was almost, and this was actually shown in an episode of Horrible Histories, which was quite interesting. Certainly back in the mid 19th century, if you succumbed to any kind of ailment, let's say you got gangrene or something, and amputation was the only kind of way to deal with the infection, you know, many of the surgeons' aprons were bloodstained because they actually wore them. It was almost like a badge of honour, you know. I mean, the very thought of that today, I mean, obviously, it's, you know, that's not very sterile, it's not very clean, and the last thing you want to see if you're going to have such a procedure performed on you. But that was just, you know, the standard of the time. You know, as many people died from the resulting surgeries than they would have done from the original disease. And he made kind of like an antiseptic spray from creosote, essentially, which was used to obviously paint fence posts and such like. He kind of tweaked it a bit, probably slightly diluted it, sprayed all his utensils and the wounds with it. He was doing, I think someone broke their leg, and he obviously put the spray on the wound and, you know, did whatever he needed to do. And, you know, he checked the wound a couple of days later, and it was healing. There was no sign of infection. And 6 weeks later, the bone, if it had broken, was completely mended. And that was a landmark revolution. And this is the same man who kind of did surgery on Edward VII. You know, again, I think he had appendix issue. And Edward VII very publicly said to Joseph Lister, "If it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be here." You know, and he's buried here.
Creosote. Well, no one's ever had a sick shed.
No, exactly. I mean, we've obviously moved on a bit since the rudimental kind of you know, processes back then that formulated many of the pioneering medical procedures we have today. But yeah, it's just remarkable to think, you know, something like, you know, painting a shed would have influenced our medicine.
I'm interested by that one. I think that's going to be less interesting than I thought. I thought we had a CND sign on one of the graves here. No, what is that? Greek Orthodox?
I presume it's Catholic. It's the
I don't recognise that symbol at all. It's like a cartwheel with six spokes, and the top one is a P.
Yeah, it's like a quarter with a P, with a long stem in it.
Listener, I'm sure there's a very good chance that you'll know exactly what that is, but it's, I'm all at sea.
Well, this is the dissenters' part. Many of the cemeteries opened with specific regions. Most of them were largely Anglican, but for other faiths such as Catholicism, Baptists and so on, they had their own little section. And we're in that part now, which is why the iconography is slightly different. For example, you have the one of the Catholic symbols of the S there on the Celtic cross. That's a Catholic symbol there. That one we've just seen there, and so on.
Can we look that up? I feel bad not investigating further.
Absolutely. Let's have a look. Let's have a look. We can talk while I'm looking it up.
Yes, we can. Okay, you can multitask.
I can, well, allegedly.
We're in the home straight, really, of the show. So while you're looking that up, tell us about how people can... Oh, you've got the image there
I've
already.
I've got the image. How did it actually come up?
What did you type in to get it up that
Catholic
quickly?
Catholic symbols.
Oh, it is a Catholic symbol.
The Greek letters chi and rho. I'm not sure. I'm sorry if the pronunciation of that is wrong. Superimposed on one another. Rendered in the form of a cross, the symbol is used to indicate Christ, since the letters are the first two letters of the word Christ in Greek. There we go, education.
Well, speaking of education, Sheldon-led education, how can people find you and get on one of your tours, and where might you take them?
Well, they could find me at the Cemetery Club, which is www.cemeteryclub.co.uk. We do blog posts every Monday, and I run a number of tours around Brompton, Abney Park and Tower Hamlet cemeteries. I've got a tour coming up shortly on Sunday, but I'm also doing a Halloween tour around Tower Hamlets, which will be obviously very fitting for the Halloween theme.
Now, I've got to raise this with you, because we had a show very recently in which the juxtaposition of the gruesomeness and the human suffering of the Jack the Ripper case I found to be an uncomfortable, very uncomfortable fit with the almost cartoonish Hollywood version of what Jack the Ripper was. And I'm conscious that I can't let what you said pass without kind of challenging it in the same way, I suppose. The idea of Halloweenishness in a graveyard seems certainly irreverent. How do you fit those two things together?
I think as long as you're respectful, and it's not, as you say, to cartoonise any kind of, you know, suffering. These are people who have lived and suffered and obviously died. And I think it's important to remember, you know, speak about how people, if they were there with you, how would you speak about them? I mean, you touched upon the Jack the Ripper thing, which is an interesting way to talk about, because, you know, as I mentioned to you before, it's basically glamorising the murder of women. You know, these are people who were murdered very brutally, and it's almost been, as you say, cartoonised, which is something I personally don't agree with. If there's one thing I want to kind of make a very strenuous point on, is that these are lives which are to be respected, and they do have stories to tell which everyone should hear.
As you say, these were real people, and real people have, some of them, senses of humour. We saw it a little bit with Alan Corran there. I think we possibly saw it with the cabbie's grave.
Yeah.
Do you see a lot of funny stuff in graveyards?
Yes, there is. I mean, especially a number of the epitaphs that people choose to have on their headstones are quite... I mean, it's nice when you read a headstone, you know, you see that, oh, here lies Joe Bloggs, died 1956, and that's all they say. It's the ones who choose to have a bit of humour on them, which is, you know, it makes you chuckle. There's one that there's an actor in here, I can't remember the epitaph exactly, but it's all in rhyming couplets, and it's about his achievements, and it's going on about saying, oh, you know, when the reader stands here wondering who I was, will they think of my achievements, or will they just go, who, you know, things like that, you know.
And his name was,
I can't remember. That's the irony of it, you see. I've read it this morning, completely popped, but I remember the epitaph. So I know of him, but I should remember. That's terrible, isn't it? Oh, dear.
Well, I think he called it then, didn't he?
He did call it. He obviously got it. He got it on. He got the nail on the head, didn't he? So good play. Good on him. Good on him. We need more people like that. Have a bit of humour on it. Why not? You know, we're only here once, you know.
Well, what better way to finish our interview here? People wanting to look you up on... I know you're a keen Twitterer.
Yes, I'm on Sheldon K. Goodman, all one word, on Twitter. And obviously I also tweet from Cemetery Club as well. So that's on the Twitter sphere as well.
Well, thanks for taking the time. We're in the very depths of Hampstead Cemetery now. It only remains for us to try and pick our way out. But for this week, Sheldon Goodman, thanks very much.
Thank you very much. My heart aches for some
far off place. And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Sheldon Goodman. Thanks to Bernie Barclay. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm in Quentin Wolfe.
ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.